As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
The Phil Hay Show.
Hello there, welcome to the show. The Phil Hay Show is brought to you by The Athletic with The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan, and with me from The Athletic, Phil Hay.
Hello.
From The Square Ball, Michael Normanson.
Hello.
Get in touch with the show's Twitter account, at The Phil Hay Show. And right now you can subscribe to The Athletic for that special price of $3.99 a month for 6 months, 40% off the full price of a sub. All the analysis, all the in-depth features from the very best team of football writers around, and you get all these podcasts ad-free. You've been cheating on us this week, Phil. Hanging around with David Ornstein and doing an Ask Ornstein as the guest, talking about Leeds' transfer plans this summer. By the way, you can find that on the Athletic UK YouTube channel. Have a look for that.
Yes, and also with the Blue Moon podcast as well, if you want to look out for that. Having a bit of a chat about Manchester City. The Ornstein questions, there's a kind of expanded version of that on the website. I think it will be on, if you're listening Friday morning, it will be on there now, a mailbag from us answering all your questions about Leeds United, including inevitably some about Rodrigo de Paul.
So it's basically just a slightly inferior version of the Q&A that we did before.
Yes, but do you know what? I'm going to pay tribute to our subscribers and readers because there are about 200 questions. And I have to say that there was only a very small or surprisingly small fraction that even mentioned the poll, which I was amazed about. It seemed as if people were deliberately showing restraint. They'd obviously been listening to the last podcast.
And are we going to get him? Is that the general vibe?
Pass.
If you want to subscribe to The Athletic, head to theathletic.com/LeedsPod. And get that 40% discount, theathletic.com/LeedsPod. And in the meantime, have a look for the Athletic UK YouTube channel for the Ask Ornstein with Phil. One thing we don't need to ask Ornstein about is Sheffield United's demise. They're very much going down and we beat them at the weekend, taking us to 42 points and a cruise to the finish line.
Yeah, we don't need to ask about relegation either. I don't really feel like any of us were thinking about it or talking about it once the win was recorded down at Fulham. I don't know about you two, but I haven't sensed at any point this season that it was looking like a real threat. And I certainly think since the wins over Burnley and West Brom at the end of December, it's felt as if Leeds were heading for 40 plus points and it felt as if they were going to leave the bottom three behind pretty comprehensively, which they have. They've obviously got three very difficult games coming up, but I think they will get extremely close to 50 points, if not go past that mark, which would be excellent return for your first season back in the division. And again, just that extra bit of class and quality that Sheffield United didn't have, that kind of assurance and confidence which seems to be growing and has grown throughout the season. I think the performance in Bielsa's second year was an improvement on his first year, and I'm now getting to the point where I think the performance in his third year is an improvement on the second. I think given the rise in standard, the jump in levels and the number of quality teams in the Premier League, to be 11th and on 42 points after 30 games is quite some achievement.
To answer that question, I think my relegation fears, it was more just a kind of lingering doubt on the periphery. I was never worried about going down. And while we're still not 100% mathematically safe, I'm fine with it. And I have been for the most part this season.
I think so as well. I think it's helped that we've never had a run of bad games. Every time we've had a bad result or a couple of indifferent performances, we've always managed to pull something out shortly afterwards. And it's we've always been a very comfortable distance, even from the opening few weeks of the season. We've always felt at least a couple of wins away from the relegation zone. And until Fulham have started showing a bit of life as well, in West Brom and Sheffield United, it's looked like there's been two relegation places gone almost within the first month of the season. So it's, I think that's helped as well, to just mean that we've had to essentially be better than a group of about 10 teams to stay up.
I don't know whether the players would ever admit to this, but it must help them psychologically to know that there are teams at the bottom of the table who are really struggling and making no progress at a time when they are picking up points. And like Michael said, there's never been a chronic spell this season. There have been little periods where the form's dropped off slightly. There have been some heavy defeats. There hasn't been a huge amount of consistency on the winning front either. It's been very much on and off. But I'm not sure you could have asked for an awful lot more than that. And the bottom line is that your teams further down the table have not been able to match it in any way. You know, have not been able to keep up with Leeds' pace or to keep up with their form. And as I say, I felt certainly from the turn of the year onwards that it was almost certain that Leeds would have a second season in this league.
I feel like part of the concern about it as well is that we maybe still don't have 100% faith in the squad, because we still have some vague memories of them under Heckingbottom and how bad they were then. And it's almost that, what if they turn back into that and we will go down? Whereas I think we can probably now fairly safely say that Stuart Dallas is a really good footballer, and that Click is good in Bamford, is all of a sudden good in the Premier League. And there's still has always been those slight fears of how bad those players have been in the past, whereas we maybe now can forget about that.
It should be said as well that there have been little spells under Bielsa his previous two seasons, particularly round about Christmas and then the very tail end of his first season, where the results have dipped and the performances have dropped. And you can never write that off as a possibility. And I think because his team do concede a lot of goals, there is always the risk in the background that the goals they score dry up and suddenly the form becomes a problem. But essentially, they've done what I think a lot of us expected them to do, which was to transfer the form from the Championship to the Premier League on the basis that the style of play and the tactical approach is very much suited to the division, I feel. It's very much suited to winning you games in this league. And while you're going to take some defeats as part of the bargain, I do feel more and more that through those 2 years in the Championship, Bielsa built a side that was not only tailor-made for that division, but was actually tailor-made for promotion as well. And we've seen that this season. It has been a really smooth transition, and it's given them something very, very good to build on, I feel.
I think the closest we came to a rut was probably around that Palace-Leicester-Wolves time. But even then, it didn't persist, did it, for very long. We got out of that particular problem quite quickly.
I think with those two games as well, you came away feeling that actually it could have been slightly different, even though they deserved to lose both. There was that point at 2-1 against Leicester where Hernandez hit the bar. There was the disallowed goal from Bamford down at Palace. Defensively, they were weak and they were a bit of a shambles, Leeds, but they were still in the games. You know, it wasn't like the slightly more comprehensive defeats where you really couldn't argue the toss over the result. And, you know, as I say, they didn't really deserve to take anything from those fixtures, but they could have done. And I think that's been the story of the entire season. They've, with a very few exceptions, they've felt as if they've been in every game and they've felt as if they've competed in every game. And even, you know, if I think of Spurs away, for example, it was very sort of comfortable and organised 20-25 minutes right up until the point where Melier gave that poor pass away and Alioski was drawn into the foul and gave away the penalty. And it has been really, really impressive. And as you say, there was never a point at which it felt as if, you know, there was this sort of creeping death of the results are turning here and this could become problematic. And as I say, I think they've got a very, very good chance of going past 50 points though.
I feel like some of the early season concerns as well were about how crucial Hernandez was last year and how he was injured and not maybe up to speed for the Premier League. But then I feel like Rafinha's arrival just blew that all away, because all of a sudden we had someone else in the team who could create something from nothing and would chip in with goals and assists for us. And that for me was a big deal.
And the defence as well, replacing Ben White and the sort of angst around not getting him. And then, okay, we'll have to find out, is Llorente going to be any good? Is Cock going to be any good? So it's just taken a little bit of time to bed in, hasn't it?
I think just to say as well that there was the question obviously over whether Bamford would be good enough, which he clearly has been. And it's not even just been his finishing, it's been his assists as well. We all thought that Phillips would be perfect for the Premier League, but you never know for sure until you're tested, and he has been tested and he's been infinitely adequate to the point where he's now in the England squad. And even at the stage where we've had this quite noticeable drop-off from Matthias Klaik, suddenly Dallas just does what Dallas tends to do. I was saying in my mailbag, he's like the T-1000 from Terminator, and that you say, can you play in goal? And he just turns into a goalkeeper. And he's now looking, I always thought of him as a competent and reliable number eight if you needed him to fill in there. But I'm looking at him now and thinking that little by little, he's turning into actually a really credible option there going further forward than this. And we did a piece on him, I think about 18 months ago now, and I spoke to Uwe Rosler, who was the manager who signed him at Leeds. And he said in there, before Dallas had really played as a centre mid, he said to me, I always thought Dallas could be an eight. We signed him as a right winger, and that's what he was at the time when he came from Brentford. But I did feel that he was that versatile, that if you got the team right and you got the balance right, or if you needed him to do it, he could play in a central area. So that sort of thing has helped. Again, when players have dropped out, it's never been significantly damaging. They've always found a way to cope. And once again, and this has been the story right the way through with Bielsa, everybody has got better.
Yeah, Dallas is remarkable. I was always persistently sort of underwhelmed with him, not quite sure what he did, what he was for. But his decision-making is absolutely impeccable. His positioning and his energy and his running is probably my player of the season, I think.
I think he'd be mine. He was my player of the season last year, although I made that choice before we had the big run-in from Hernandez, and it was Hernandez who took the club's player of the year award in the end. But I think I made the point last season that up until the lockdown, I'm not sure you would have included Hernandez in the shortlist for player of the year. He'd been good and he'd been effective, but he hadn't been standout, and he wasn't standout until he was touched by God in those last nine games. But when you said there, I've never really known what Dallas is, I would agree with you, but I think we've discovered what he is, which is just wildly versatile and incredibly able when it comes to a manager saying to him, can you play here and can you play competently? And him saying, yes, can, and adapting extremely quickly. And on the basis of form at the moment, you wouldn't play Click ahead of him. I'd absolutely have Dallas in that midfield. I don't think there's a choice to be made.
Just returning to Saturday then, and the one to watch we picked out was Heckingbottom last week, for obvious reasons. I mean, Saturday's game, returning to the theme we said earlier as well, it never felt like we were playing with any pressure on Saturday, whereas you could say the opposite of Sheffield United. It was just desperate at times for them, wasn't it? And there was that spell in the second half where we'd sort of pegged them back into their half and they'd have possession, but then just give it up to us every five or six passes. It was absolutely crazy. So that's what led me to the question of, when Heckingbottom said that Leeds made subs to live with Sheffield United, they made subs to live with us, that's delusional, isn't it?
Yeah. Bielsa made the point afterwards that Leeds spent a lot of the game getting into very good positions and not making anything of them, and that was the case. It was 2-1, but I felt Leeds should have dug 3-4 goals out of that game quite easily. I wouldn't criticise Heckingbottom too much for Sheffield United's performance, given that he's been there for been in charge for two or three weeks. But looking at them, it did remind me a lot of Heckingbottom's Leeds, in that they were kind of there and they were kind of competing and they were kind of organised, but there was no real identity, there was no spark, there's no managerial bounce, which I think was the story of his entire time in charge at Elland Road, that it just never took light and it never got going. It never felt as if there was a transition from Christensen's team to Heckingbottom's team. You felt as if the massive muddle that had been left by Christensen just persisted right the way towards the end of the season, at which point Leeds decided, look, this is not working and we need to have a completely different strategy and to take a different view of this. As I say, it felt like they were making up the numbers and they are now there to see out games. And I think if beforehand you couldn't really see much logic in Heckingbottom being manager long term at Sheffield United, I think after that game, you're more and more inclined to think that they need something completely different and a new thought. The substitutions, the late introduction, I guess, of Robin Koch for Stuart Dallas was a bit of a substitution designed to tie things up. And there was a little hint at the end of, a few opportunities for Sheffield United to nick a point out of that. But I think it's stretching it to say that over the 90 minutes, Bielsa was making substitutions to cope with Sheffield United. I think Sheffield United spent the entire game coping with Leeds.
Would you like to see Hecky go back to repeat his achievements at Hibs?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody who can do that is in my cool book, 100%. The feeling seems to be with him that this might get his taste back for management. I don't mean the results and everything else, because clearly it's going to be a pretty grim end to the season, but just being back in the dugout and back around the first team squad and doing that sort of coaching. But it's so long since he was, or it feels so long since he was last managing, that can't be the answer for them down in the Championship. And as I say, they were sort of in the game, they were there, they were kind of giving it a go. But I think kind of giving it a go is probably the best you could say about the period when Heckingbottom was in charge of Leeds. There was just nothing more to it than that.
There was no threat, was there, from Sheffield United?
It reminded me of the the game against Newcastle where we put five past them, and it could have been that again. I think it was, there were the chances there, we just didn't take them, or at the last minute we'd misplace a pass, and it looked like we carved them open, we'd just squander the opportunity. But they didn't, in the same way as that Newcastle game, I left thinking, I don't know what it is they're trying to do, really. They're just turning out on the pitch. It's like, it has a vibe of almost a Sunday league team where you're like, just go and get in 4-4-2, lads, or whatever. Just go and play some game.
Have you not often thought that, though, with a lot of the managers in this division, that sometimes when you look at what Bielsa's doing, and then obviously to a greater extent you're talking like Guardiola and Klopp, they're just playing like a different sport to some of the coaches at the bottom end?
Well, I'm not going to be disrespectful here, but on Monday I went to Harrogate Town because Rebecca Welsh was referee, the first female referee to be appointed to an EFL game. Harrogate lost 2-0 to Port Vale. And this sounds very obvious, but the gulf between what we see with Bielsa and what I saw at Harrogate, and admittedly it's not a great pitch at Harrogate, and you're talking League 2, you know, mid-table League 2, but it felt vast. And I felt like looking at the players as well, you're seeing a different type of athlete, a different sort of body shape, a different athleticism to what you get in the Premier League. And I think even in the Premier League this season, you're right, that there is a bit of a division in the sense that there are some teams that don't seem to have that about them. There are some, like Bielsa's, who definitely do. And I guess the most satisfying thing about Saturday was that you always felt that the win was coming. Even though Leeds were kind of making heavy weather of making the best of the good positions they got into, and they had plenty of good positional play, you just sensed that they would have enough because they've kind of got into the mindset now where they believe they've got enough, and they're very, very good at getting the best of these games that are pretty tight. And they deserve to win, without a doubt. As I say, the whole thing about Leeds making substitutions to cope with Sheffield United, I didn't follow that at all.
I think the ease of the win as well has to be set against the backdrop of them knowing their fate. Like when we played them early in the season, that was a game that genuinely could have gone either way. And there was a really good save from Melier in there. And was it our second game of the season? It felt like it was a proper battle with that one. Whereas this one, it felt going into it like we would win comfortably. And the game felt panned out much like that as well.
That's why I said going into it that I'd rather face a Paul Heckingbottom Sheffield United than a Chris Wilder one. Because I mean, Baldock did scrap and fight for every ball, didn't he? As we saw very, very graphically. But I think a Chris Wilder side has got more bite about it than that Heckingbottom one, which was fairly toothless.
Whether it did towards the end, I'm not sure, but it certainly did back in. I think it was third game, actually, wasn't it? A second away game, but that was tight, and it could have gone either way, that, although it deserved to go to Leeds in the end. But that early Melier save was key. It felt on Saturday like Leeds had the measure of that from the start, and you're right. I mean, all the imagination has gone out of Sheffield United. They've known for a long, long time now that they're toast and they're going down. But I think those are the games that you've still got to make the most of, the games you've still got to win. Those are the games that are pretty embarrassing if you end up losing them, like Newcastle, for example, did away at Bramall Lane. So a good result, and just keeps things ticking over.
Just on that Baldock challenge, I know it was in a way quite nice to have a game without any VAR. What was the thinking behind that not being looked at by the referee on the pitch?
I have absolutely no idea. I can only assume that because he'd banged his head, and he had, I think initially after the challenge, there was that suspicion of, is he milking this so that Graeme Scott forgets about the fact that he's gone in two-footed? But when you saw the replay, he did bang his head very heavily on the ground as he went into that tackle, and given that he was replaced not long after and was quite clearly looked to be suffering from concussion, that there's no doubt at all that it did have a big impact on him. But that was a red card. I mean, it didn't even seem like a particularly difficult decision. And because of the impact and the sort of aggression of the tackle in real time, it was one of those that made you wince slightly. Roberts got absolutely crunched. It stood to reason that naturally the referee, if he wasn't sure himself, would have said to the VAR, have a look at this, because I'd like to see this again. I'd like to know what went on. And given that it was two-footed and it was a bit of a scissor challenge and everything else, I don't understand why, if it wasn't looked at again, that decision was taken not to refer it. And if it was referred, how it is that that's gone by whoever's looking at it, and they've thought, no, that's not a red card. The fact that he's been concussed or he's banged his head is neither here nor there. That has to be looked after, and you have to be careful with his treatment. But it doesn't preclude the referee from giving him a red card, which he should have done.
Is there any mechanism in place for the clubs to ask the question on things like that?
Very much so, and Leeds have, over the months of the season, have asked from time to time about decisions like, for example, Bamford's disallowed goal at Crystal Palace and others others like that that have been a little bit confusing. And on several occasions, PGMOL or whoever answers the questions have come back to them and said, yeah, look, we did make a mistake there, or this is why it was done, or we can understand why you were unhappy with this. I don't know whether they've asked about Baldock on Saturday, and I don't know whether there would really be any point. I mean, I said to somebody on Twitter after the game, there is almost no purpose in discussing this anymore because so much of it is so baffling and it just seems to be so repetitive that you almost just have to let it lie. But so I would be surprised if they haven't asked for a bit of clarification about it, because as I say, it looked like a blatant sending off. But I think I'd be more interested first and foremost to know whether Graeme Scott did actually refer it, because if he didn't, I can't understand why not.
I do wonder if, because they were engaging the concussion protocols, and if VAR has, because they check everything, I think, don't they? So if VAR has looked at that and said, well, he's banged his head off the floor, therefore he couldn't have intended to do what he did. It must have been a slip. Do you think there's a logical pathway there?
I suppose so. I suppose you could make that argument, but it didn't look like a slip to me. It looked as if he was diving in for the ball. And you would say that even if he has slipped, he's quite clearly out of control, so it's a dangerous tackle and it is putting Roberts at risk. And I think on those grounds, you have to say to yourself, that should be a dismissal. One of the things I've found really odd about VAR when it comes to fouls is the number of times that a challenge will be referred to the VAR to look for a red card and the VAR will decide no, but it won't result in a booking either. So what you're effectively saying is that the referee wanted to check, was that worthy of a red card, but didn't think it was worthy of a yellow card in the first place. It's, the whole thing is just really peculiar. And it feels to me, I mean, we're a season into this now, and obviously Leeds are quite late to VAR, given that it was introduced before they were promoted. But it still feels a long, long way from settling down to the point where people are content with it.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's talk money. The accounts for the 2019-2020 season came out in the last 7 days. That's the accounts for the promotion season, the first effects of COVID. And we've seen quite a sizable loss. But underneath that, actually, it's nowhere near as bad as you might imagine, because echoes and PTSD from Ridsdale era says, oh, massive loss is terrifying and could jeopardise the club. But it doesn't look anywhere near the same sort of problem. And especially with the Premier League finances as astronomical as they are.
Easter Sunday announcement, this one, and every football writer will tell you that it is the highlight of their year, particularly club writers, when the accounts are released and you start getting into all these bits and pieces that you don't understand and you desperately try to pick out from the numbers that are in there. The loss, you know, the bottom line loss looks and is very sizable, £62 million. I'll go through this as kind of logically and as orderly fashion as I can. The thing about Ridsdale and the debt that Leeds built up back at that stage was that the debt was built up and kept growing in the Premier League. So without Champions League qualification, and even with Champions League qualification, it was difficult stroke impossible for Leeds to find the revenue to deal with those debts. There was simply never going to be any way to wipe those out without administration or without some kind of financial wizardry to make that happen, unless you had somebody buy in like Abramovich or the Abu Dhabi investors at Manchester City, something like that. It was always going to be a catastrophic problem. These obviously come in the 13 months before promotion, and the reason that they run to 13 months is because obviously the season was delayed, so Leeds extended their accounts just to cover the end of the season.
Just to explain there, the football accounts normally run July the 1st to June the 30th the following year, and then the new football calendar year starts on July the 1st. That's when contracts start. That's why you always see signings officially announced around the start of July.
That's right, or at least free transfers are always done at the start of July, because that's when deal ends and then they're free to move on. And clearly, if it hadn't been for COVID, the season would have finished in May, as we all expected. So this financial year would have been 12 months rather than 13. And the purpose of the 13th was purely to extend it beyond July the 22nd, which was when the season actually officially finished. A couple of things to say first is that of the £62 million loss, £20 million of that was paid in promotion bonuses to players and staff. And these are contractual commitments that every club has and that every club is required to pay when they go up. Obviously, the amount and the cost of it will differ from club to club. But in Leeds' case, for promotion, there were bonuses of £20 million across the board. There was also a TV rebate, Premier League TV rebate of £7 million, which, despite the fact that Leeds were in the Championship, it was shared, that the cost of that rebate or meeting that rebate was shared between not only the existing Premier League clubs, but also the clubs that were coming up, of which Leeds were one. And there was it was £2 million odd, which is not an insignificant amount of money, but in the grand scheme of what a club like Leeds now earn, it's a bit of a drop in the ocean. But that was the effect of COVID and the loss of crowds towards the end of the season. They projected that the turnover would be around about £56 million. In the end, it came in at £54 million. But they have submitted an insurance claim for that loss of cash for the £2.5 million, and that's been accepted. So essentially that will fall into the next accounts. So they could have pushed the bonuses into the next accounts quite easily. They could have pushed the rebate into the next accounts quite easily, in which case you would be deducting £27 million from the overall loss. And rather than £62 million, you would be looking at closer to £30 million. It doesn't mean that it wouldn't have been an issue if they hadn't come up. The EFL in the Championship still has strict rules on profit and sustainability, which, according to the statement in these accounts, Leeds were compliant with in this year. And you'll remember going back, 12 months, 18 months, a lot of talk from Angus Kinnear in particular, but Radrizzani also, about the fact that Leeds were pretty close to the PNS limit, and that was why they were having to be a little bit careful with transfers, why they couldn't push it too far, because if they did breach the scale of losses that they were allowed, there were going to be sanctions and they'd be at risk of a fine or transfer embargo or whatever else from the EFL. So what we can deduce from this is that had they not been promoted and had they stayed down, they would have had to have made some fairly significant cuts. I don't think there's any doubt that Calvin Phillips would have been sold, and the sort of fee they would have earned from him would probably have covered much of the loss anyway. But the wage bill, even without the promotion bonuses, was up over 55, 56, 57 million pounds, so more than the overall turnover. And they would have had to have tightened their belts without any question. I mean, I was saying in a piece this week that there was a bit of chat towards the end of last season about the fact that Bielsa was inquiring about what the average wage was for a Championship manager. I think he realised that if promotion did go begging and he was going to stay on for season three, he couldn't expect or ask to be paid the salary package that he and his staff were being paid, because there were going to have to be some trimming of the fat. They were going to have to operate in a slightly more frugal manner. But the reality is that they did go up. They have been promoted. They do have Premier League income. If you look at the cash in hand and cash at the bank as of the end of these accounts at the point where they've been promoted compared to where they were 30 months earlier. 30 months earlier, they had just under £500,000 in cash, either in hand or at the bank. At the end of these accounts, they had £31 million, and that was essentially because the first tranche of Premier League TV cash had landed. And that makes you realise that, yes, the bottom line loss figure looks very high. Yes, you can understand why people would be concerned about that. But financially, they're now swimming in completely different waters.
Yeah, the losses allowed in the EFL, £39 million over a rolling three-year period, isn't it?
Yeah, so without a doubt, they've pushed it to, they've gone as far as they could in this year. And I think it's safe to say that having missed out in Bielsa's first year, had they followed that up by missing out in his second year, given again the excellent position they were in, it was very difficult to see how in the season that followed, i.e. this season, they would have anything like the same chance again, because they would have had to have made changes to the squad. They would have had to have thought seriously about the size of the wage bill. But it was and is a very calculated risk. I think they knew the reasons why they were going for Bielsa. They knew he was going to be expensive, but they also understood and told themselves what the make weight of that would be if it worked. And it has worked absolutely spectacularly. And there was a line from Kinnear in the accounts in his statement where he said the biggest risk to Leeds is divisional status, effectively, which is to say that if they get relegated, then there are big problems, you know, and that's true for most Premier League clubs. But it would certainly be true for Leeds, particularly after the investment in players last summer. But he said, you know, the whole idea of the project was to build a structure that was good enough not only to get promoted, but to stay there. And staying there was almost as critical as going up in the first place. And given that with 8 games to go, they're 11th and they're on 42 points and they're safe, they're now guaranteed a second year of Premier League income. And you can't in any way say that the gamble with Bielsa wasn't worth it.
Yeah, and it's not even really it's not a big gamble either, is it? I mean, the figures are frightening, particularly when we factor in the Ridsdale, you know, or the aftermath of that. But this was a calculated gamble. It's worth stressing that because the rewards when you get there, as we've seen, are just so, so vast.
Question is always as well, who's picking up the tab if you make losses? So Kinnear told you, I know, and told several of us journalists that Radrizzani was paying $1 million to $1.5 million a month in loans to cover the wage bill because, you know, the turnover wasn't high enough to cover that. And if you have an owner like Steve Gibson at Middlesbrough who is willing to pick up losses year after year after year, you can continue to sustain them. The problem comes if those losses start to breach P&S and if you find that you're either under a transfer embargo or that you're not able to recruit in the way that you want to, or you find yourself being forced to sell players who are absolutely critical to the style of play. I mean, if you imagine Bielsa staying on and Phillips leaving, which I'm absolutely certain Phillips would have done. You know, there was this kind of gentleman's agreement that he'd sign his 5-year deal and he would give it another go at Leeds. But you are talking about somebody who's now a fully fledged England international and is a Premier League footballer, and who it wouldn't have been fair to say, look, you need to devote your entire career to Leeds, regardless of what division we're in. At some point, you know, his individual ambition was going to stretch out and take him elsewhere. But if you imagine Leeds without Phillips, as good a coach as Bielsa is, that would have been extremely difficult to allow for. And it would have been extremely difficult for them to have maintained exactly the same style at the same level of performance, minus that key figure in defensive midfield. So those would have been the implications. It's not to say that the losses would have been damaging in terms of the health of the club, but it might have set them back in terms of trying to get promoted. You know, you might have then been back into a long stretch of attempting to reset, attempting to go again, but finding it quite difficult because that momentum and impetus that you have is kind of kiboshed, that it hits the wall. So I do think it was critical to get promoted, but not from the point of view of the survival of the club.
It does feel like there's more of a squeeze on the Football League finances, and it's getting tighter and tighter every year when you see what an absolute car crash the whole thing is. The good thing about all this, the great white hope, if you like, is the revenues, that they absolutely smashed it out of the park, even with COVID factored into it. They've done tremendously well there. And it feels like now we're in the Premier League, they're only just scratching the surface there.
There was a deliberate target, Radrizzani and the board, Kinnear and Orta, that the target was to hit turnover of 50 million plus, which was way in excess of other sides in the Championship. And they've done that. You know, even in a COVID year, it's gone to 54 million. And the merchandising numbers at £50 million are massive for that division. And should, in theory, have gone up quite spectacularly this year, given that they've had the Adidas kit deal and they seem to have basically completely sold out of kit and training gear. One of the things that jumped out to me and that I thought was interesting was the fact that had there not been COVID and had the last 5 games of the season had crowds, there would have been very little difference between the gate receipts in Bielsa's first season and the gate receipts in his second, which explains again why it is that they're looking at the redevelopment of the West Stand and the North Stand. And I think it might not be too long before we see the button getting pushed on that, because that is the obvious area where you can grow commercially and financially. That's the area where if you bump the capacity up to 55,000, the differences are very, very significant. And because they've been packing out since Bielsa came, you know, the uptake of tickets has been massive from the point at which he came through the door. There is no scope to increase on that. There are no extra seats. There are no extra corporate facilities. It is what it is, to use a terrible phrase. And they're almost maximising the money they can make from the stadium. But if the stadium is twice as big again, or almost twice as big again, then the numbers and the graph starts to spike quite dramatically. So that was one of the things that jumped out. And I think one of the things that underlined why it is that they want to make that expansion.
Just to go back to the insurance policy, which we're claiming on, is that something that other clubs have had in place, or is that something that was specific to Leeds? Because it's not something I've really heard talked about. All I've heard is talk of how much clubs are going to lose. This suggests that actually there's something there to cover it for Leeds.
I haven't looked through other club accounts to see if there's anything like that in it, but I would assume that if Leeds have that provision, others might as well. But it's important to say that, for example, it hasn't covered the TV rebate. So even though that is a consequence of COVID, they aren't able to claim back that £7 million. It's purely covered what I think was the gap in commercial income. And as I say, if they had that insurance, you would assume that the other clubs would have done as well. It's important to say as well that there is financial support behind Leeds. I mean, the accounts make reference to the £23 million purchase of shares by 49ers Investment, which happened in December. So that's obviously been pretty crucial working capital for a club who've had the revenue streams chopped. There was a reference as well to further loan facility of £43 million, which I think almost certainly refers to forward funding deal that a lot of Premier League clubs do. I wrote about this after the transfer window, but essentially clubs organise loan facilities with banks or lenders, and it's secured against TV income and it's paid back in instalments. And in order to make sure that you do pay it back and that it doesn't become a liability that you can't meet, the TV money is paid directly by the Premier League to the lenders to make sure that the integrity of the whole system is held up. So it's not in any way unusual that, and a lot of Premier League clubs do it, but it does just, again, give you a bit of extra cash, a bit of liquid capital at a time where clubs definitely need it.
Because that's the sort of like hot button thing that's going to panic Leeds fans when they think, oh, we're borrowing against future TV revenues. But like you said, there is a really definite structure in place there that the Premier League is involved in, and they see that the revenue goes back. That's important to stress.
And also think about the numbers. As I said, the cash in hand and at the bank was £31 million, which is the first of three portions of broadcast revenue that comes through the season. And again, Leeds are going into a second season in the Premier League, so we'll have these big hits of money coming again. That's not to say that they don't have big expenses. And my understanding of the wage bill, which was around, I think, around about £58 million in the Championship, is that it will nigh on have doubled. So it will be much closer to £100 million in the financial year that we're in. So it's not as if all the money coming in from TV cash is there to be spent on whatever you feel like. You know, that there are always liabilities. But that's just the reality of running a club. And I think it's safe to say that there are plenty of Premier League clubs who are operating with forward funding deals and finance them no problem at all. And Kinnear said last summer when they did the deals for Rodrigo and Rafinha and Llorente and Robin Koch that part of the reason for spending as much as they did last summer was so that there wasn't excessive pressure on them to carry on spending like that. It's not to say that they won't do deals in the next window that comes around, because they definitely will. But I think the kind of mindset at Leeds was that we don't want to be spending or committing £100 million in each window, because it's not particularly prudent and it's not particularly sustainable. And if you actually build a good squad, it shouldn't be necessary either. So there's always a balance, but I think the feeling generally is that it's unfortunate that they've gone up in a COVID year, because clearly that is gonna leave shortfalls in the accounts, as it will everywhere. People will have seen the figures over at Manchester City, which were very, very steep in terms of their losses, and a lot of that was COVID related. But there is a feeling that by getting promoted and getting, being able to dip their feet into the money that's in the Premier League, they'll be fine.
There is an argument that says, though, even though we've lost revenues due to COVID, it should squeeze the transfer market a little bit as well, because other clubs, you've seen TV deals collapse in France, for example. There should be a fairly rich seam to mine there if we're going for players this coming summer. So you may get the trade-off there. It's also worth stressing that £100 million in transfer fees committed last summer isn't all payable last summer. It's stretched out sometimes over the terms of contracts, or sometimes over 2 or 3 years.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, they amortised all of the fees, and clubs generally tend to do that. From what I was told, I don't think last summer they spent more than around about £3 million on a single individual player there and then. And I think a lot of the deals were weighted so that the payments got steeper and increased as you went through the contracts. So again, I mean, that sort of stuff is all in the background, and you've got to be mindful of it. And nobody is going to pay that money for you. You need to use your income and you need to use your revenue to fund it. But as much as expenses and everything else spike quite dramatically in the Premier League, so does the income. And they're on a completely different plane now when it comes to earning money, not just TV revenue. I know that's what you get bogged down in talking about, because that is the bulk of it. But they've got a shirt sponsorship deal which has jumped from around about £750,000 a year with 32 Red to more like £7 million with SBO Top. The Adidas kit deal will be significant amount of money. That there will come a point where crowds come back in, and commercially you're able to properly exploit the fact that you've got Premier League football at Elland Road rather than Championship football. So I do genuinely feel like they're in a pretty good place. I don't think there's any doubt that they need to stay in the Premier League to stay in a good place, but that applies to just about 20 clubs in that division.
Just looking at the other side of the finances as well, like, you know, they said they budgeted for finishing 17th, which would bring, let's say, on an average year, about £100 million worth of TV and prize money. Whereas actually, if we finish around mid-table, given everything, and the number of times we've been on telly, it's probably going to be more like, as we said the other week, 130 million. So already you can see an extra maybe 30 million quid of revenue that they hadn't budgeted for this summer.
There's also no sign at all of Bielsa dropping off, you know, in terms of his expectations for individual games or anything else. I was writing after the Sheffield United game about the 23s, because the 23s at the moment are very, very close to being promoted from the Premier League 2 division, which they are going to win by a country mile. And I know that Bielsa uses ringers, if you want to put it that way, in as much as you will see Hernandez roll up in those games, you'll see Rodrigo roll up in those games. Rafinha has played in 23's games this season. But I think it's still fair to say that the best performances amongst that group have come from the actual bona fide 23s like Gelhard and others. And when you looked at the squad on Saturday, it was almost entirely senior footballers. You know, it was starting to get to the point of being a near first choice squad. And actually this weekend against City, Bielsa will have, with the exception of Adam Forshaw, and obviously Jack Harrison is ineligible, but he's fit. He will have basically a fully fit squad, you know, which is pretty much unheard of in his time. And this is the point of the season where on 42 points, you get that old cliche of play the kids, give the kids a go, blood the kids. And I actually think it's probably quite likely that we'll see Bielsa harden in the other direction, because he won't want to be seen in any way to be throwing any of the games or to be taking any of the games lightly or to be experimenting in matches that have consequences for other teams in the division. And I thought, you know, I thought that was pretty noticeable on Saturday, that you do have this outstanding crop of 23s, of which, you know, some of them look seriously, seriously talented. But actually, his mindset at the moment is still to go full strength and still to play as if everything matters. And perhaps it'll be different when you get to the end of the season and you're playing West Brom and they've been relegated. But on top of that, you know, we were saying that position in the Premier League worth around about £3 million, there is still financially something to play for. And clearly they're not going to get into Europe and they're not going to go down. But it doesn't mean that the matches don't count. And Bielsa said that before Sheffield United. He said, you know, no position in the division exempts you from making effort.
So as a bleak pessimist, Michael, would you, even you, concede that the club's in pretty rude health at the minute?
I'm more concerned about the collapse of the whole thing, you know, the TV deals falling around. I mean, in truth, there is a long-term concern about it, because a lot of the TV deal, that certainly the UK TV deal, is based upon companies trying to sell other things as well as football. So Sky try and sell you broadband and a wider TV package, as do BT. Amazon try and get you to use Amazon Prime, which you then use to buy drills, batteries, jigsaws, whatever you're buying from Amazon.
Well, welcome to Normanton's world.
So that sort of, it's not just about, you're not just buying the football from these companies, are you? So I guess if the whole model changed at that point, the TV deal could dip. But you could have said this at any point in the last 30 years, like the TV money might drop, and it doesn't ever seem to do, does it? So
I think the game has kind of put itself in collective peril, isn't it? So if anything seismic like that was to happen, it's going to have consequences for everybody. And in the same way that if you go down into the Championship and you look at the figures and the amount of money that's being lost, it's horrific. But nobody seems to be able to do anything about it. And how can you, when the disparity between the Premier League and the Championship is so massive? If you're going to compete, with rare exceptions, you do really have to do what Leeds have done, which is push the numbers. I mean, I always remember Chelino's first financial year. He tried to get the player wage bill down to around about £13 million. And he did it. And the club-wide wage bill was 19, you know, it was less than 20. So almost a third of what it is at the moment. And you're only talking 5 or 6 years on. And you remember that Adam Pearson was there at the time as his sort of de facto chief exec and advisor. And I spoke to Pearson about it back then, and he said, I understand why he's doing this, because, you know, the club's a mess financially and it needs to get more orderly. But from my experience of the Championship, a wage bill of £30 million is not going to get you promoted. So if you're happy to accept that, if you're happy to accept that it's probably going to lead to mid-table football, you can operate in that fashion. But if you start to come under pressure to compete for promotion and to compete properly, you know, to be in the mix as Leeds have been or were for two seasons running, You've got to spend more than that. But of course, clubs don't have the income and the means without an owner to fund it, to spend that sort of cash. They don't have that money available, but they still try to spend it. And the whole thing is in a complete mess. And people have been warning about this for years and years, and it's a free market, so nothing ever really happens. And the Premier League just seems to, certainly prior to COVID, just seems to get richer and richer and richer. There's more money there. And it is problematic. But, you know, like Michael says, you could have the monumental collapse of TV deals overnight one day. But is any club going to be immune from that? I mean, Manchester City probably would be to an extent. Chelsea might be fine with Abramovich. Everybody else is going to have real, real problems.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Match day 31 for Leeds United on Saturday lunchtime at Manchester City, who will be completely distracted by the Champions League. So a definite nailed on 3 points for us, even if we are without Jack Harrison, as you mentioned before, Phil.
Definite nailed on 3 points. Actually, I mean, Guardiola did say himself that if there was a game he could have avoided in between two legs against Dortmund, this would definitely have been it, given that Leeds are going to run City into the ground irrespective of the result. And also the Dortmund game is very, very much in the balance ahead of the second leg in Germany. So Guardiola is going to have to manage things fairly carefully. I mean, they are just, I know they've got the extraordinary squad at Eastlands, but they are fighting on all fronts, literally, this season. And I think we'll see changes to his team. I think there'll have to be changes to his team. But let's not kid ourselves about their form or how they've played for most of this season. I think the encouragement for Leeds would have to be the way that the first game at Elland Road went, which I still feel was there to be won for Leeds up until probably the last 10 minutes. And actually, if I'm being totally honest, not by no means the best result of the season, but I do think right up there with the best performances, given who they were playing, and more to the point, the way that they worked that game out from a pretty difficult position 20, 25 minutes in.
It was a coming of age game in a way, wasn't it? It was a welcome to the Premier League because we looked a little bit rabbit in the headlights for that first early, was it 20 minutes or thereabouts, that spell. I reckon we give ourselves a chance. If we do that again, if we capitulate in the first 20 minutes and concede, then I think we'll probably lose on Saturday. But if we can keep it at least tight enough that we keep a foothold in the game for 20 minutes, then I think our chance increases as the game goes on.
They were very clever at Elland Road to begin with, in that Guardiola used Mahrez as a bit of a sort of false nine, but up front. And out of possession, he basically cut off the passing lanes to Phillips, which meant that Phillips in the middle of the field was becoming pretty isolated and finding it very difficult to get on the ball. But also, for those 20 minutes, he and Cleek just seemed to be shadows behind Foden and De Bruyne. I mean, I've seen loads of Foden and De Bruyne over the years, but not too often in the flesh. And in those 20 minutes, you did just think, Christ, you know, look at the quality here. And I guess the skill and the intensity of the play, it was almost impossible to live with. But what happened that night was that basically Phillips and Cleek started to work out what they had to do in order to get back into the game. So Phillips started taking up different positions, shifting out wide if there was space out wide. Cleek started to get on the ball, started to put more pressure on Foden and De Bruyne in particular. And little by little, they got on top of the midfield. And it was very clear by the second half, once Rodrigo came on and once Leeds got the bit between their teeth, that neither De Bruyne nor Foden were enjoying the game anymore. And I don't think Guardiola was either. And it really did take the introduction of Fernandinho off the bench with about 10, 12 minutes to go to settle that match down from City's perspective. That was the decision that kind of killed the game and meant that the kind of overwhelming style that Leeds were playing in and the pressure that was on City dissipated a bit and you know, kind of left the game to run to a 1-1 draw. And there was a quite a big shout from City for a penalty late in the game as well, which was a very, very borderline decision. But in spite of that, I thought Leeds were the better team for most of it. And I think they'd have merited a win on the night. And as I say, given that a lot of sides turn up against City and get a good old pasting, you would definitely take some encouragement from that.
Man City do feel like a bit of a different team than the one at the start of the season. And at the start of the year, they were kind of being referred to as like a Man City tribute team. And they kind of looked like a Man City team. And there were times when they sort of were passing as that, but then there just wasn't that same rhythm and stuff there. Whereas I think we can well and truly say that they now have that.
Have they been made to look better, though, by the lack of anybody else putting together a good run in the Premier League?
Well, you could apply the same argument to Liverpool last season, couldn't you? In that there was a big drop off from City, but I don't think that changes the fact that Liverpool were a very, very good side last season and extremely consistent. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was a little surprised, and I think other people were too, when City stepped in and gave Guardiola a new contract, because you did have it in your head that perhaps he was coming to the end of the line there, and perhaps the book was about to close on what he'd done. And it's that thing about cycles, isn't it? Can he make City go again, or has he done everything that he can do there, a little bit like it was at Bayern Munich? And it feels to me that since they made that commitment and since they took the decision to commit to him and to say, no, do you know what? He can do this again, and he can pick the club back up. It's looked very astute, and it's looked as if it's helped. And I mean, their run of victories up until losing to Manchester United and since then as well, it's just been extraordinary. It's like relentless, and Michael is right. I think they're a different animal now to the animal they were back when Leeds first played them. But I don't think that changes the quality of the performance from Leeds in that first game. And I don't think it means that Leeds don't have a sliver of a chance at Eastlands.
I mean, I've seen some tweets this week of people saying, can we just forfeit the game and take the 3-0 defeat and move on? And I think that's a little bit, and it's a bit negative. I think we're better than we realise we are.
Yes, I think it's probably safe to say that you wouldn't put money on taking anything from these next three games. I think you would hope that Leeds would. And the one thing that is definitely missing from this this season is a big scalp. We had Bielsa's presser earlier, and someone said to him, you know, your record against the top six, top seven is not particularly impressive this season. Is that the natural flow of things, or actually should you be doing better? And he said, it certainly stands to reason that a promoted club are not going to start throwing the weight around and knocking out your established sides who are regularly competing for the title or for Champions League places. But he did say that is something we want to address, and it is something we want to improve on. I think he's aware that there are sides around Leeds in the table who've had some very good results against some of the bigger teams. And you know that in the same way as he was able to get Bilbao to compete with Guardiola's Barcelona and everything else, he would like to see the same happen. And the reason that Guardiola didn't want this to fall between two Champions League legs is because Leeds tend to run further than anybody else. They tend to push you harder than anybody else. They don't tend to bail out of games, even if, like at Arsenal, they're 4-0 down, you know, or at Old Trafford, the 4-0 down, it just keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And it's very difficult for, you know, even if City win the game, it'll be very difficult for them to win this at a canter. But without any doubt, they're very, very strong favourites.
I think the fact that the Dortmund tie, is nicely poised, it does give us a bit of a chance. And I can see the logic in people saying a 3-0 defeat, we'll just take it. And in some respects, we could be here in a week's time having lost 3-0 and saying, well,
yeah, it might happen. Yeah.
Not a bad result, you know, whatever. But let's see.
It could at least be fun. Take it after the game, though, rather than beforehand, yeah. Saying, yeah, I get beat 3-0, never mind. Yeah, absolutely never mind at the end of it. But we go and have a dig, and particularly because it's not as if you need to be in any way concerned about the results that are coming later in the day or over the rest of the weekend. That's the bonus of the position they're in, is that even though Bielsa would never let you ever talk about dead rubbers or games that don't matter, there isn't going to be any consequence of these matches for Leeds. And they kind of are there to be won if you want to look at them in that way. I think City will win this. I do think it will be a home win because they just have quality everywhere and the form is absolutely ludicrous. But I don't think Guardiola saying that this is the worst game they could have had is lip service. I think he probably means it.
I mean, there's respect built into the fact that he rested a few of those key players against Dortmund in the first leg through the week.
Yes, I mean, I suspect, given how they played against Dortmund, it'll be a very similar side over there, but he does have options. I mean, plenty of options. So you would think we might see people like Sterling play. We might see Fernandinho come in. There is Aguero, if he wanted to give Aguero a go. Torres, Mendy, you know, there will surely be some shuffling of the team because he has to prioritise the game in Germany next week. In the same way as Leeds are basically safe, the title is basically won. There's just no way City can drop off to the extent that they would need to for anybody to get back into that. But the one thing about Guardiola is that he clearly hates losing games. I think he's like Bielsa in that sense, that he doesn't want to sit back and say, well, it doesn't really matter because if we win in Dortmund on Wednesday or if we qualify over there, then that was the priority of this week. You can tell from their recent form that he absolutely loves these big streaks of victories, and it's what he lives for.
See the way he tackles the League Cup as well, in that he does rest players in it, but he also tends to leave in at least five or six solid first teams as well, because he just, as Phil says, he likes winning every single match that he plays.
Just going back to what you were saying, Bielsa's comments about the table, I'm just looking at the table now, and broadly speaking, we've beaten the teams below us and lost to the teams above us, with the exception of Leicester, Everton and Villa. So I guess when you start to chip away at those teams above you, the top sort of eight or whatever, get a few more wins from them, that's how you start to creep up the table and you start competing at a higher level.
Yeah, it is. And that'll be the purpose of any business that's done over the summer, will be to try and consolidate this and to drag Leeds a little further up and a little closer to some of the sides who are above them. I mean, he has the benefit, Bielsa. As I say, Harrison will be missing this weekend, and you would assume that will most likely bring Hilda Costa into the team, which will leave a decision whether to switch Rafinha over to the left, which I hope he doesn't, but Costa does seem to be more effective down the right when he is effective at all. But that will most likely be the only change. And with the exception of Forshaw, everybody else will be available. So Bielsa almost has a very, very marginal advantage in that he can use his players as he pleases without having to worry about what's coming further down the line. I think Guardiola will have to manage it slightly more and be mindful. But that is not to ignore the extent of the quality at City, which is miles beyond what Bielsa has in his squad.
Do you think maybe as an alternative they put Click into midfield and push Dallas to left back and Alioski further forward on the left?
Well, Alioski did play in the first game, so it's a possibility. I just don't think you would be taking Dallas out of the midfield at the moment. It might be that he does that. It's a definite option. But if you did do that, you would need a much bigger performance from Click than we've seen from him for quite a while now. And I said earlier in the podcast that Dallas is starting to look actually like almost like a first choice number eight, and you know, he was probably man of the match against Sheffield United, a few other contenders as well, but he would certainly have been in the conversation, and because of that I think I would be inclined to keep him there, and Bielsa isn't often drawn into big sort of tactical switches like that if he doesn't need to.
One to watch then from the weekend, and some predictions for it. You're obviously going for home win, Phil, because you said so.
Yes. Again, it's the midfield battle for me, because that, to my mind, was the critical thing in the first game at Elland Road. It was the period to begin with where Foden and De Bruyne were on top, followed by the period where Phillips and Cleek started to dictate play. Whoever gets the upper hand there and whoever controls the pitch in that area will win without a question, or at least should win the game. I think any time you're up against City and they dominate in that zone, you're in a lot of trouble, but equally that is true when Leeds do the same. So, you know, really, really fascinating tussle coming there.
I think on our podcast, I might have predicted 6-3 to Man City or something ridiculous, which is not inconceivable, I would say.
No, I think that's quite a good shout, actually. Something wild and off the wall, yeah.
And I'll try to enjoy it. Just be grateful that we're not watching, you know, Richard Keogh. I know it's hard watching good players do good things against us, but probably better than that, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I expect us to lose, but just for the sake of balancing the universe and optimism, I'm going to go for a Leeds United win.
Well, why not? It makes me wonder what Guardiola would make of a 6-3 City win. Would he be able to sit back and say, that was really enjoyable, you know, that was a great spectacle and terrific for the neutral? Or would it eat away at the perfectionist in him, thinking, that's not the way my games should be going, you know? I expect to win games 6-0, not 6-3.
He can probably drop another 60 million on a centre-back then, though, can't he, to try and fix it?
I've just realised I said, I expect us to lose, but then I also said on the Square Ball podcast, we'll draw, and I've just gone for a Leeds win, so I've covered all bases.
Every base covered, yeah. Home win for me, I think City will win 3-1.
I think Leeds, if we are going to win, it's we get an early goal and then we get a second goal not long after that that goes completely like it blows our minds, blows us out of the water. We don't expect it to happen. But one of those magical days that Leeds very occasionally have on the telly.
Yeah, could be. Could be. Let's hope.
Just returning to something you said there about planning for next season, do you get the sense that the club are on now with some transfers? Are things starting to tick over behind the scenes?
They've been on for quite a while. I think pre-Christmas and then through January, most of the work was done, certainly focused on what would come in the next window, given that they didn't plan to spend much or anything and in the end didn't do anything at all in January. There's obviously the issue of what's going to happen with Bielsa. Is he going to commit? Will he stay? Will he extend his contract? I still think that the odds are yes, he will. But actually, if you look at the team, it's fairly apparent, isn't it, where players are needed. I always say I think a left-back has to be one of the main focuses, given that there still isn't anybody really holding down that position. And if you get cover Phillips and you get another midfielder in the 8-10 mould, I think, give or take, you even with a different manager, and let's hope it doesn't come to that, I think you'd have a lot of what you needed.
When will Mino Raiola's European tour be arriving at Leeds Bradford?
That would be great, wouldn't it? That would be great. We did a piece on The Athletic. You know, I was off on the day, actually, so I wasn't able to write about Leeds, but it was basically, how would you sell your move to Haaland? And I was thinking about all the things being Norwegian that might appeal to him, like escaping Castleford, all that sort of stuff, yeah. So let's hope. But no, something tells me that we won't be seeing him wandering through arrivals anytime soon.
Well, if he does move in the next year or two, we'll get him when he's at the peak of his career. He'll go to one of the leading European clubs now, 3 or 4 year contract or whatever, and then that'll expire just as he's coming to his peak and we are in the Champions League again. That's the plan, isn't it? Getting to Europe in the next 4 or 5 years. Perfect. He gets to come back to Leeds, you know, stadium, 55,000-60,000, Champions League football. It's all set up for 3 or 4 years down the line.
The idea that he's not already at his peak is a bit terrifying. What's he? Is he going to get bigger, stronger, faster?
He can't, absolutely. Can't he's get any like, bigger, can he? I know he's like genetically engineered by the US military, isn't he? But if you rewind 15 years, 10 years ago to the kind of darkest EFL days at Leeds, he is the sort of player who would have been linked with Leeds from the age of about 33 onwards and would eventually have signed at the age of about 36 and done next to nothing and left. And you'd have been sat there thinking, if only this guy joined it at his peak. But crazy money.
Just returning to the realistic transfers for a second, because I have great fun going on Wacko, going on the transfer thread there on the forum, and they dissect every word you say, Phil, and they're trying to figure out where the up to five signings, are going to come. So can you offer a little bit of clarity on what you think the club are going to do?
Phil does actually have a list in his wallet of five players he knows we're signing, but he just doesn't want to tell anyone. Yeah.
I'm going to start doing this in Japanese just to add to the fun, try and dissect that.
I mean, does your opinion, does it come from, I know you speak to them and you've got an idea about what they're doing and you speak to agents and so on and so forth, not to give away all the secrets, but is it based on what you see with your eyes on the pitch?
No, it's based on what you hear and what you're told and who you speak to. I mean, a lot of it's fluid in the sense that, say, for example, Kessié goes. If they find a club for Kessié, or if Kessié asks to leave and they're able to do that, then you're going to see a goalkeeper coming in, I would imagine. If Kessié sticks around and commits to the club, then you don't need another keeper. It seems to me that the real sort of priority positions, left back, cover for Phillips and attacking midfielder, I think those are the three that they would definitely want to do. But he's always kind of open-minded, his author, about other things that he might do. I think even in January, despite the fact that they'd kind of telegraphed the intention to do very little, stroke nothing, and to avoid spending money, they're always sort of on the toes, so that if something comes up at the last minute or comes up at short notice that is worth doing, they'll go and do it. I mean, clearly, Cuisance, for example, from Bayern Munich, and Rafinha are not even remotely the same player. You know, completely different players. Cuisance went under week or so before the transfer deadline. Rafinha became an option 2-3 days before the deadline passed. And because they knew, and because Arthur and Bielsa knew how good Rafinha was and how good value he'd be at £70 million, that deal was done. So you landed a winger where a week earlier you were looking at a centre mid, and in the end no centre mid materialised before the deadline. So it is all quite fluid, and it can move and it can change. I think it will be similar to last summer in that I do think they'll have a reasonable amount to spend, and I don't think they'll be shy in the amount they spend, but it won't be massive numbers and it won't be a complete tear-up of what's there, because a little bit like last summer, they still have a lot of faith and a lot of confidence in the basic core of the squad.
And it feels like they want to keep that, you know, absolutely paramount. That is so important to it's evolution, not revolution, as the phrase goes.
Well, also, which of the players who were promoted with them and have been regulars in the team would you say have been found out this season? I don't think many, stroke any, really. I think they've all coped. How they'll cope in season two is another question, because you do see, as we've seen with Sheffield United, but it's happened at other clubs as well, you can see a decrease in form and a decrease in consistency in the second year when, I guess, the adrenaline goes and a bit of the momentum from promotion is lost as well. But, for example, would you go and look for another right-back to replace Ayling? I don't think you would. Do you want a different defensive mid to replace Phillips? Definitely not. I still think they need cover there, but not a first-choice option. Dallas looks absolutely fine. Click looks tired, but I think when he's played well this season, has looked absolutely adequate for the level. And, you know, Bamford still has a chance, if he gets on a little bit of a roll, of getting close to or up to 20 goals this season. So the transition's been really, really good. And it cuts out the need to, or it cuts out any panic and the need to look at the team or the squad and say, do you know what, some pretty drastic changes is needed here. It'll be the same attitude, particularly if Bielsa stays, that most of these will make up the spine of his team next season.
And it doesn't feel like we're about to do a Sheffield United, does it? It feels like we have enough quality in the squad to stay up going forward. It felt like that Sheffield United team, like, massively, massively overachieved, whereas it feels like we've done maybe marginally better than you could expect.
Well, that's what the table reflects. Actually, what I was saying before, we've beaten the teams below us, broadly speaking, and lost to the ones above us, so we're about placed right in the table.
And the Sheffield United team is based around people like Chris Basham, who are kind of getting older and truthfully have never actually been top players. They kind of were at the twilight of their career and doing very well. And people like Billy Sharp with crucial goals. It doesn't feel like we're built on sand in quite the same way.
God, the way you said Chris Basham there, it reminds me of a book written by a Scottish football writer, a guy called Bill Leckie. And he was talking about bumping into another journal, Graeme Spears, who used to write for The Scotsman and Scotland on Sunday, which was, you know, kind of high market newspaper in comparison to some of what Leckie wrote for, which is like The Daily Record or The Sun or whatever. And he said he bumped into Spears, who I know to speak to. He said they bumped into him, and Spears said to him, I heard that the other week you went to somewhere like Alloa. You were at Alloa to report. And Leckie was saying, except he said Alloa to rhyme with gonorrhea. like that. The way you said Basham there, I just thought, oh dear, bless him. I do feel like there are differences. I think one of the major ones, hopefully, will be that this summer, you'd like to think that Leeds across the board, so from Radrazzani to Kinnear to Otter and to Bielsa, will be on the same page in the way that I think it's safe to say Sheffield United want last summer. And you would like to think that the recruitment will be more skillful and more targeted and more in tune with what they actually need to move forward, as opposed to what felt a bit scattergun at Bramall Lane, particularly when they got around to spending so much on Brewster late in the window. So yes, I think without being complacent, they ought to have more of a platform and more stability than there was for Wilder.
And it's fine anyway. If Bielsa does walk, we can just get Corbyn back from Huddersfield, can't we? And those checks, notes, etc. 7-0 defeats.
Ouch.
Yeah. Get in touch with us via Twitter at The Phil Hay Show and subscribe now to The Athletic for that price of $3.99 a month for 6 months. It's 40% off the full price. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod to do that. TheAthletic.com/LeedsPod. We'll catch you next week. Bye-bye.
The Phil Hay Show.
Brought to your ears by The Athletic, I'm Adam Hurry, and Football Clichés is the podcast you never knew you needed. Every week, to quite unnecessary depth, we examine the words, the phrases, the accepted wisdom, the mannerisms, the habits, the gestures, the symbols, the sounds, and the smells that everyone takes for granted in football, but which really are the glorious glue that holds it all together. For example, have you ever really listened to the Football League goals roundups? I mean, really listened to them? Because they all sound pretty much like this.
Team X went into this game with just one win in their last 13, and when Team Y took the lead inside 4 minutes at Stadium Z, the home fans were probably starting to fear the worst. But Striker A had other ideas, and this game turned on its head in the space of 5 minutes midway through the second half. First, a smart finish from the edge of the box brought Team X level, and he repeated the trick on the hour mark to bring his tally for the season to 22. By now, Team X were in the mood, and although striker A squandered a gilt-edged chance to complete his hat-trick, on loan Dutchman winger B made it three with a curling effort from long range. Team Y's misery was compounded in stoppage time when midfielder C's late challenge on fullback D saw them reduced to 10 men. An afternoon to forget for manager E's men then, but Team X will hope they have finally turned a corner under caretaker boss manager F. Listen to Football Clichés wherever you get your podcasts, and also ad-free when you subscribe to The Athletic.